from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk to the three gentlemen running this year's Indie Jazz Fest. Plus, Matt Sosi joins us for a special chat with musician Bill Langton, who will be performing at the Jazz Fest.
And I'll get a preview of the BoucherCon Mystery Writers Conference with author Hank Philippi Ryan. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR.
In its 11th year, Indie Jazz Fest is under new management. Sharon Gamble got the three Jazz Fest musketeers to put down their charts long enough to come in for an interview to tell us about the changes they plan to make and why Indie Jazz Fest has something for everyone.
Well, gentlemen, since we do have three gentlemen here, and it's radio, so they can't see that you all are very handsome, but you all look very different, I'm going to ask you to say your name when you answer my first question, which may take you on a trip down memory lane. Tell me who you are and how you first encountered jazz.
Well, I'm David Ali, and probably when I was probably still in the womb. I imagine I hear stories about my dad putting headphones on my mom's belly and probably trying to prime me about the John Coltrane or Miles Davis or something at a very young age. But I remember taking all the records and spilling them out onto the kitchen floor and scratching them. So,
oh, ouch.
Very early age. So,
Rob?
My name's Rob Dixon, and I definitely discovered jazz and music just a little later. I think I was in elementary school at the time, maybe like fourth grade, and we had a music group come to our school, and it left such a strong impression on me. It had horns and drums and a bass and a guitar. I got the bug to play music. So I begged my parents to get me an instrument, and the rest is history, I guess.
How'd you end up with a sax?
Well, I ended up playing saxophone because my initial interest was to play the drums, but we had too many drummers in our school.
Aww.
So it was like, you pick something else, and I picked the saxophone. So, and then I got a saxophone that was really rusty, and I didn't like it. So my parents told me if I played the saxophone really well for, you know, the following year, that they'd get me a brand new saxophone. And they got me another used saxophone, but it was shiny.
And it was new to you.
It was new to me, which was important at that time that it would be shiny. Just so, you know.
Right. Al, did you have a shiny introduction to jazz?
A little bit dull. I started a little bit even later. I was probably 16, 17 years old and living in San Francisco, and we would get our fake IDs out and go up into North Beach area, which at that time was very famous for a number of jazz clubs, and just sort of hung out there as much as we could till we got kicked out. And next weekend we'd try again.
So congratulations and yikes. You guys own Indie Jazz Fest now. That is a not inconsiderable thing to take on. How did you decide that, number one, it was worthy when American Pianists Association said, we need to get out of this business and transfer it to someone else? How did you decide that it was worthy of continuing, and how did you decide that you were the ones who were going to somehow make time in an already busy life to take this on?
That's a good question, and we're still asking ourselves that ourselves. But we have been participants of one way, shape, or form in Indie Jazz Fest over the last number of years. And any time you do that, you sort of say to yourself, gosh, if we were in charge, here's how we would do it. And you're right, the opportunity did come up last December, and we made an offer to take it over. and met with the city people and the parks people and all of the downtown arts people, and sort of got a nod from everybody that this would be a good thing to do. So we took it on and have been scrambling around ever since, trying to find out what all of the moving parts are and putting them in place.
And it's really an event that's kind of, even in its first decade, has reinvented itself a little bit. So that's sort of part of its identity, to mix it up, change it up a little bit every year, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we want to try to keep it fresh, but I think it kind of what I was speaking to was, you know, that we definitely saw some directions that we would have liked to see the fest go in. And, I mean, we've started that with even some of our year-round things with the education and being in the schools. And we felt like in order to make this thing successful moving forward, we need to cultivate a wider net, a wider base of jazz listeners. And so the education's a big part of it, and then the fest itself, we had some definite ideas on, you know, some of the booking and you know, types of jazz that we wanted to see out there and hear out there. It's really a tool that I think that the jazz community can use to you know, bring people into this music. There's a lot of misconceptions, there's a lot of people that don't understand the music, and so we hope to dispel some of those things. So, you know, the fest is set up to be a fun, family oriented, accessible, you know, open-armed a fest that has a lot of facets that a lot of people would enjoy. So, you know, that's kind of where we're moving, and that's what we've you know, strive to accomplish this year, is to kind of reinvent it and just let everybody know, hey, this is going to be fun, this is going to be a great time, you can bring your family. So
it's kind of ironic to hear you say to educate Indianapolis about jazz, given our jazz heritage. That just feels like, oh, wow, how do we not know more about jazz? What happened? Where through the years did we fall down on the job? What happened, you know?
Well, I guess, and that's a hard question
to
answer. I know. Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that, what you were thinking I was going to say. But, you know, music education and jazz education and just, you know, creating awareness about all the things that have happened in Indiana, in Indianapolis and also Indiana, I think that's kind of something that is not touched upon in too often or not often enough. You know, we have a great history. Indiana does. I mean, Jeanette Records was the first recording label that actually recorded jazz. You know, there are so many great legendary musicians and composers that come from Indiana. Not only Hoagy Carmichael and Cole Porter, and then you have the world-renowned David Baker, but you have J.J. Johnson and Freddie Hubbard and Wes Montgomery and Sly Hampton, all musicians that have kind of defined their instrument in jazz. The definition of jazz trombone is definitely J.J. Johnson. So I think going back to that first question you asked, why we thought or to take such a monumental task on, I just felt like, and I think we all collectively felt like, well, this is a known entity. Indie Jazz Fest is now in its 11th season. The legacy is so great here in Indianapolis. I think we have as much claim on jazz as New Orleans, or, you know, and New York, or any other place in the world that, you know, has jazz. We have as much claim on the music. And I think that we saw the potential, not only the great things that have happened in the past, but the potential of the great things that can come out of really celebrating the legacy, getting more of awareness in schools and more awareness in the community about history and the jazz culture here in Indiana. So I think that we were excited about that part. The other thing is the way that the construct of our festival this year is kind of based on, you know, our collective experiences in going to different festivals around the world, saying, man, this is a great festival. This aspect of this festival is wonderful. This aspect of this festival is wonderful. I think we've kind of, you know, made fashion a jazz festival based on the best parts of other festivals that we've seen.
Very smart. I was curious as to, from playing in and attending other festivals, if you have non-Indianapolis favorite festivals.
Myself? Well, you know, New Orleans is always a great festival. They have a great festival in the North Sea. Jazz Festival is great. And then Montreux. Europe always, you know, all throughout Holland, they have a couple festivals there. There's a festival in Norwalk, Connecticut that is very nice, you know, the way they have the stage set. And the Playboy Jazz Festival is great for a number of reasons.
One of the things
they're smiling at each other. I don't want to go there.
One of the things we're doing that is different from those other jazz festivals. Having grown up in California, my favorite was Monterey Jazz Festival. That almost all of them will start out with jazz, and then they will soon after that go over into blues and go over into other forms of music, which I think is great. And but it's not jazz. So
right.
to term those festivals jazz festivals mm-hmm. is a little bit of a misnomer. We have come back full circle, the Indy Jazz Fest, and we have all jazz. There's some variations on that theme in terms of jam band, which is really a jazz derivative. And there's others, but it will be a true jazz festival. So that if you're a jazz fan and you hear that the mainliner is a blues person, you're likely not to come because blues is blues and jazz is jazz.
Sure.
And although there's some similarities, you might not come. This is going to be pure jazz. So those jazz fans out there, or those that want to become jazz fans or explore that genre, this is where you have to be.
I wonder when you're deciding who the performers will be is part scheduling, part finance, but also given the wide number of styles that all fit under the very big tent of the term jazz, how do you make that balance? How is it scientific, or is that something you, how do you do it? What's the methodology there?
Well, I think it's a combination of all those things. I mean, you're right. Finances play into it. Timing, whether or not the artist that maybe you would have first liked to have chosen is available. But I think you try to have a little bit of a, for us at least, you know, I mean, you know, just like we program at the Jazz Kitchen, you know, we try to program certain nights that are more, you know, maybe early swing, some nights that are more kind of funk edge to them, some that are more straight ahead, a la, you know, a Miles Davis or a John Coltrane. So we're kind of taking that same approach with the festival. And in fact, in this year's fest, we've even taken that approach a step further in that we've even chose venues that kind of will maybe present that style of music maybe better
mm-hmm.
or at least it's in its natural environment, if you will, like the jam band show with Charlie Hunter and Garage Mahal and whatnot at the Vogue. You know, that's a natural home for that style of music.
And it's a very different setting than Joshua Redman at Clues.
At Clues Hall, that's right.
Different vibe.
Or there's certain bands that I think portray better outdoors. Like I think larger groups portray better outdoors. Sonically, it projects better. I mean, there's also things that we wanted to try, like Pancho Sanchez, besides being a fantastic Latin jazz group, also brings a great deal of energy to the fest. So, you know, the person that's out there that, say, isn't like the quintessential jazz aficionado can get up and move around and, you know, and have a good time and still be on a high level of musicality. So, there's a lot that goes into that, but I think, you know, we probably book a lot of it on gut, you know.
Sure.
We really like this band. We really like the way they connect with the audience. They're good
right.
people. I mean, we feel like we've booked a lot of good people on this show, too, which, you know, is great for the audience here. We want, you know, we want the artists to interact with the crowd and be happy with their time here in Indianapolis
sure.
and really share a great musical experience with the audience. So
yeah.
And your shared vision, plus your colleagues at Owl Studios and Jazz Foundation and Jazz Kitchen, you're creating a personality for this festival through your shared sensibility in a way.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that that is a big part of what we are trying, the message that we're trying to send out this year about this festival. We want the people to have know that we're trying to do this more in a grassroots kind of way,
mm-hmm.
Have musicians more interactive with people, not so have it such like, oh, you're going to see a concert, you can't talk to these people, they're far away.
They're up on a pedestal.
They're up on a pedestal.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that you were speaking earlier about how we book people with the finances and reaching certain demographics. I think the one thing that trumps all of that this year is we booked people that we thought that were going to present a very entertaining show. So you may not know who they are, but we know that they're going to put on a show that everybody's going to like, they were great. They were fantastic, you know. I think there's some, you know, names on the list that might be sleepers as far as name recognition to the general populace, but once they see the show, once they come down, I think they're going to have a great time, you know, so.
Well, and some of them people will know. I mean, we do have a good representation of local musicians, and getting back to a previous question in terms of heritage, we're trying to get into the school system and teach them about jazz. We have three high school bands that are going to be playing, one that from Fort Wayne Snyder, so we'll have a lot of folks come down from Fort Wayne. Ben Davis High School Jazz Band will be performing on Sunday. And then the band that we've put together, the IPS All City Jazz Band, which is a resurrection of what historically has happened in this city. And it went dormant for a while, and we're trying to resurrect that too.
I'm sure the kids that you've already encountered have been gaga and just very enthusiastic, because this is not what's traditional, sadly, not what they think of when they think music education. But have the educators been welcoming? Have the music teachers said, thank gosh, you're bringing this back. Oh, my, this fills a very important void.
I think they feel like it fills a void, definitely. With them being, like, gaga over it, I think, you know, the educational systems are plagued with so many other problems. They're like, you know, so I don't think anybody can get too excited about anything right now, the state of the economy and
sure.
the way things are going. But I think that they've been very supportive of what we've asked to be and how we've asked to be involved in the school system. So they're excited and we're excited, and we think that this is just the first step in a long relationship. So.
And I know you guys will all be back to talk about this, because Jazz Fest is not just this once-a-year event. This is an ongoing. This is going to be year-round. It's going to take over your lives even more than it has already. But you're willing.
Yeah. Well, I think jazz has already taken over our lives for a number of years. And so you kind of had asked the question, you know, why does sometimes the decline or something about that, you know, maybe jazz isn't as prevalent or hard to get out. I think it's, you know, we talked about this about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. This is an opportunity for the jazz community to really collectively bind together and put out a united front. I mean, you mentioned the Indianapolis Jazz Foundation. That's an organization that's been around for 15 years. It's now coming to the fold, is really stepping up their efforts as far as jazz education and just promotion of the jazz idiom in general. Obviously through the efforts of what we've been doing all year long, but then we're getting the schools involved, and it's, you know, we're chipping away at it, and we're getting that united front. And you know, we look upon, you know, some of the arts community, you know, the organizations out there. IMA does a great job of really cultivating things. Obviously the symphony,
zoo.
I mean, so really we look at them with a degree of jealousy, you know, that we would like to see that for the jazz community. So I think we're taking really important steps this year to make that happen. And when you talk about the year-round effort, you know, it doesn't stop at the end of September. I mean, you know, we live and breathe this music all the time. So, you know, it's a year-round 24/7 for us.
Labor of love.
We're just trying to spread the disease a little bit.
right.
Well, you know, I think... Oh man, I think that we also saw the potential. There's a conference called South by Southwest, and it's in Austin, Texas. It's music, and Austin has become known as Music Town now. They have 70,000 people descend upon Austin, Texas over that week, and they have music there. And we thought, with the history and the legacy and all the great things that Indianapolis has to offer jazz wise. This is a great that could be a something that we shoot for. If we could have 70,000 people descend upon Indianapolis for this festival soon, maybe this year.
In our dreams.
In the next couple of weeks. Yeah. We can get there, though.
Sharon Gamble with the Jazz Kitchen's David Ali. Yes, he's the son of Steve Ali. Saxophonist Rob Dixon and Al Studios owner Al Hall. You can get pre-sale tickets and special package tickets at IndieJazzFest.net, that is .net, and Jazz Fest starts this weekend, and there are events all around town with artists as diverse as Joshua Redman and Pancho Sanchez to Cynthia Lane and Mark Pacelli. Catch the 10 in-store performances by the Indie Jazz Fest band at Marsh, so you can shop and bop, as you will. And also stay tuned for Matt Sosie's interview with jazz guitarist Bill Langton.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Art of the Matter. Guitarist Bill Langton has been an Indianapolis jazz staple for decades. This year, his group, the Bill Langton Coalition, will be performing at the Indie Jazz Fest on Saturday, September 26th. Matt Sosie spoke with Bill Langton about becoming a part of the Indianapolis jazz scene and its history.
My dad was a musician, a jazz lover. He was a big band conductor and arranger, and at one time actually conducted at WJR. In Detroit, radio stations back in the day had big bands in there, and they were live, and they did the shows, and my dad was the arranger and conductor for those. So I actually listened to jazz growing up, his albums, and Benny Goodman and Mills Brothers. They love vocalists and that type of stuff.
How did you get turned on to guitar?
The Beatles.
Now, when did it shift to jazz guitar?
Well, I always, interestingly enough, I mean, I loved the sound of guitar on my dad's records, like Charlie Christian with Benny Goodman, that type of stuff. So I was a guitar aficionado. I think, at, 13 years old when the Beatles came over, we just all got caught up in the idea of playing the guitar.
Sure.
And playing rock music. But I always had that background of listening to jazz guitar also. So really by the time I was 18, I was playing a little bit of everything, rock and jazz. And I got caught up with Carlos Santana and that type of stuff. So I had a broad spectrum of influences.
And when were you first introduced to Wes Montgomery? Because I'm going to say this right off the bat. I think when it comes to indie jazz history, people think Wes Montgomery. Mm-hmm. And I think when they think of Indianapolis modern jazz guitar, that's you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate that. And, it's interesting because Wes, probably I really got into Wes after he had passed away. And I came out here in 1970 to go to college, and that's probably at the time that I started really getting into his style of playing and the octaves and that type of thing.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Indiana State.
And you studied music?
No, journalism.
Perfect endeavor for a musician.
My mother said, I was married to a musician. You're going to have something to fall back on.
You too, huh?
So.
Okay, now I have to ask, when it comes to Wes, how did you feel about his pop covers in the second half of his career? Since you mentioned the Beatles.
Exactly.
Earlier.
And I'm one of the ones who believes two things. One, that it was a right decision for him to do that because he for the first time in his life, he was financially stable. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the records, really his playing isn't any different. I mean, he's surrounded by strings and he's doing songs like Going Out of My Head and Tequila and that type of stuff, but he's burning on them. You know, he's playing really well. He didn't try to alter what he does at all.
It was almost like the jazz equivalent of Dylan plugging in at Newport. I mean, it really
for
wrinkled
critics,
a
yeah.
Ja-
yeah.
Okay, jazz yeah. critics. It wrinkled a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So after college, you stuck around?
Well, I went back to New York for a minute, and
a New York minute.
Yeah, I was trying to, you know, see if I could get a job in journalism, and I came out here and I interviewed at different places. The Indianapolis Star at that time had a freeze on, you know, hiring cub reporters, but and I think at the time a cub reporter made about $115 a week, so I ended up going on the road, playing in bands 6 nights a week, sometimes 7 nights a week, and making a lot more than that. And you know, before I knew it, I was in my 30s, and music was my career.
Well, how was the jazz scene at that time?
Actually, there was a lot. The entire music scene in Indianapolis was a lot more active. You know, we were playing literally 6 nights a week.
It's and, a luxury nowadays.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, just as an aside here, a friend of mine, when Les Paul passed away, said, you know, we've lost a great one, and he said, you know, we should be so lucky as to have a regular Monday night gig when we're 94. And I wrote back, I said, I should be so lucky to have a regular Monday night gig now, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, because it's just, you know, it's not what it used to be as far as the amount of work available. So you really have to do a lot of different things now. You have to do corporate, you know, more corporate things, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do different teaching. I teach a lot and stuff like that, you know. But back then, there were a lot of clubs that were running music all the time.
What's one of the main things you teach a new student when it comes to jazz or guitar?
Well, normally, a new student, I don't really take on new students. But if I have a student, I mean, I don't take on beginning students.
Right.
Okay. But when students come to me, most of my students are either playing jazz guitar in their high school jazz band,
mm-hmm.
or they're adults that are playing guitar and want to go from being a blues player and understanding more about jazz. But we really, you know, my teaching philosophies have changed over, you know, over the last 20 years. I used to be very into the theoretical aspect. You know, it's a lot of theory. You got to learn this, you got to learn that and stuff. And over the years, it's developed more towards working out of repertoire, still applying theory, but taking a jazz standard tune and analyzing it and discussing, you know, section by section, what kind of, you know, scales you can use in these sections and why, as opposed to just teaching the scales and teaching the scale.
How many bands are you involved with currently?
Well, I actually have several groups that I do. I have a trio, which is pretty much more of a straight-ahead kind of thing. My coalition is a seven-piece group, which is going to be performing at Jazz Fest.
Right.
And with that group, we're doing a lot more originals of mine and a little funkier, more Latin-type stuff. I've currently gotten re-involved with the band Dog Talk.
I saw that you guys had a mini reunion. How
yeah,
was that?
Yeah. Great, yeah. It was really fun to get back together with the guys, and, you know, we hadn't played together in a couple of years, but it's kind of like riding a bike. You know, we got back on, and everything was fine.
Everybody's good?
Yep.
Now, was it the festival people, or was it your idea to bring the coalition to the festival?
It was really my idea. I was pretty much given a choice of what I wanted to do.
Nice.
But I really enjoy... We've been working lately with the coalition with the three horns and just doing great shows. And I really wanted to bring that since we're going to be playing on the big stage. I wanted to have that nice, you know, good, powerful sound.
And I know also next month at the Jazz Kitchen, you're going to be hosting another Indianapolis Guitar Summit.
That's correct. Yeah.
How many of those have you done so far?
We started that in 2002. We've done it twice a year at the Jazz Kitchen since, so this is 7 years now. And, you know, we do some other little festivals and stuff like that.
Who's going to be a part of the October Summit?
Well, definitely myself, Frank Steens, and for the first time, Peter Keenley. from Bloomington is going to be coming up. And it's always, I'll tell you what, the guitar summits are always a lot of fun. I mean, it's just, it brings out the best in all of us. We all love each other, and but we're not afraid to try to show each other what we can do.
Matt Soucy with musician Bill Langton. The Bill Langton Coalition will be performing at the Indie Jazz Fest on Saturday, September 26th, on the lawn at White River State Park. You can go to IndieJazzFest.net for more information. And right now, we're listening to Bill's album, Yeah Man. Well, Sharon, it's that weekend where it feels like there's just so many festivals and events and things going on that I think we're going to have to actually make it a short calendar so we can get out and enjoy some of the stuff.
That's exactly right.
Okay, but there are some things we want to mention still on.
What
do
we do?
Because I want to get to Orange tonight, and Irish Fest is going on right now.
And Fiesta.
And Fiesta is going on as well. It's just, it's a busy weekend.
It's a very busy weekend. I want to mention also a couple of performances on Saturday night at 6 and 9:30 for a very tongue-in-cheek romp through country music. The show is the Patsy Decline Show. It's going on at the cabaret at the Connoisseur Room, the Patsy Decline Show, Saturday night at 6 and 9:30. Crazy, wacky.
That is such a great space to see a show. That's going to be a fun one. Hey, there's some really neat things going on at Eagle Creek Park coming up in the next couple weeks. As summer turns to fall, a great time to go out there and enjoy some nature and also check out the art exhibit that Eagle Creek's doing with the Riviera Camera Club, the 21st Annual Images of Nature Photography Exhibit that's in the Earth Discovery Center, running now through the 27th of September. And then also on October 3rd, that's Saturday, October 3rd, it's Eagle Creek's second annual Fall Festival Day, which features music and games and foods and carnival games for the kids and prizes and lots of great activities all day. And you can do things like go on a hayride and, again, enjoy the Earth Discovery Center. Great way to spend a beautiful fall day out at Eagle Creek.
And fall officially arrives this week, so it's
just in
time. If you are looking for a laugh, whether you're a musical comedy fan or a straight play fan, you might want to check out The Pied Piper of Hoboken, written by a friend over at the Indianapolis Business Journal, Lou Harry. It's at the Sam's Building at 6150 Hillside Avenue, going on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock. You can contact workforlou@aol.com for more information, and you might give him a heads up if you're thinking about going.
Very good. And last thing I want to mention is next Saturday, the Smithsonian Institution is having their official 5th Annual Museum Day, and to celebrate that, the President Benjamin Harrison Home is offering free admission all day next Saturday. A great day to check out the Harrison's beautiful estate and grounds and museum about the features, of course, President Benjamin Harrison.
Very fun. My last item on our quick calendar is the opening benefit concert with Jamie Laredo, Ida Kavafi, and Steven Tenenbaum, Sharon Robinson, the Miami String Quartet, and you probably guessed it's a concert benefiting the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis. It's coming up on Tuesday evening at 7:30 at Indianapolis Civic Theater at Marion University. You can go to violin.org for more information or to get tickets for that.
Very good. And we'll be back next week with more on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Hank Philippi Ryan grew up in Indianapolis and began her career as a TV news reporter and anchor here in the 1970s. For the past 22 years, she's been with Boston's NBC affiliate as an investigative reporter, for which she has won 26 Emmys. A few years ago, Hank combined her love of mysteries with her experience as an investigative reporter to write the first book of her mystery novel series titled Prime Time, which introduced Charlie McNally, who just happens to be an investigative reporter for a Boston TV station and who solves murders. Travis DiNicola spoke with Hank about her books and with Jim Wang, the owner of the Mystery Company bookstore, about the upcoming BoucherCon World Mystery Convention taking place in Indianapolis.
I'm an investigative reporter, the investigative reporter for the NBC affiliate in Boston, and I have been since 1982, which is kind of wild. And before that, I worked for 5 years in television in Atlanta, and before that, here in Indianapolis at WTHR. As a reporter. I was a general assignment reporter for years, you know, fires and politics and whatever happened to happen that day. Starting in 1988, I began to do more long-form journalism and do in-depth stories, and I've been doing that ever since.
And you've won a number of Emmys for it as well.
26.
Congratulations.
But let's hear it for longevity.
Wow. That's really incredible. Quite a testament to your career, though. I think the Agatha Award has also probably got a great spot on your mantle as well for other awards you've won. You won an Agatha Award for your first mystery.
Isn't that amazing? And you're so right. The Agatha Teapot, the Agatha Award for Best First Mystery, is actually a black ceramic teapot. And it is sitting on my bookshelf back home in Boston with a little pin spot on it. And I must say that it is one of my absolute treasures of my life to have been welcomed into the mystery world with that acclaim is, I mean, I want to say it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's more than that. It is one of the pinnacles of the mystery world. And
it really
I still get goosebumps thinking about that.
Now, this was for your book Prime Time, which is the first in a series. The most recent one just came out, which is Airtime. This series, I'm really intrigued about because the character, well, is also an investigative reporter in Boston, correct?
Shockingly so.
Wow.
I mean, I dug deep for her. When my husband talks about Charlotte McNally, the main character of the books, he calls her you. He'll say, when you track down the bad guys or when you get held at gunpoint, and I say, sweetheart, you know, it's fiction. But, you know, after 30 years as a reporter, it would be silly for me not to bring my experience to bear. I've wired myself with hidden cameras and confronted corrupt politicians and chased down criminals. I've done stories about topics that people don't want to have be made public, and I've had my share of threats and difficulties and many a door slammed in my face. So I wanted to bring that authenticity to the novels, to the mystery novels. And I also wanted people to understand what it was like, A, to work in television, where you can never be 1 second late. Mm-hmm. You can never make a mistake. I mean, imagine having a job where you can never make a mistake. And that's a TV reporter. You can never get someone's name wrong or pick the wrong word. And you can never have a bad hair day because
that's why I like radio.
absolutely so. Also, to be someone who, a woman who's my age, in television, we feel sort of that we have a little sell-by date, use-by date stamped on our forehead. And so in television, there is that tension of someone who knows what they're doing but is older than might be in the demographics. And I wanted to use that as a theme also.
Had you been a mystery fan? I mean, during all this time, have you been a great reader of mysteries, lover of mysteries?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely so. From the moment I read my first Nancy Drew, I was a geeky, kind of nerdy teenager. And Nancy Drew was my first best friend. I mean, she was cool and she was smart and she made it okay to be smart. And I read the clue in the old clock and the clue in the diary, which I thought was clue in the dairy for the longest time. Anyway, yes, of course, I loved mysteries. And I went, you know, Agatha Christie and all the Sherlock Holmes short stories. And in, you know, started with all the wonderful British women authors, Niall Marsh and Josephine Tay, and just devoured all of those. And I have never, I mean, that I started reading mysteries when I was, how old are you when you read Nancy Drew? Seven?
Sure.
And I've, you know, been reading for 50-plus years.
Now, did you make any attempts before the series with Primetime, starting that off? Had you made other attempts to write a mystery before, or was this something new where you said, you know, I've been enjoying mysteries all this time, and now I'm going to bring my experience to it, or was it... What prompted you to it at what point say, this is when I want to start writing this book?
You know, it's such a great question, because what happened was I had a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I had what I thought, and I still think so, was a great idea for a plot. And I'll tell you very quickly.
Okay.
I got an email at work. It was clearly a spam. And I opened it by mistake, one of those junk emails that clogs your computer. I opened it by mistake, and its inside was a... Instead of something about refinancing, the subject line said, you know, help with refinancing. It was what looked like lines from a play from Shakespeare. And I thought, why would someone put lines from a play from Shakespeare in a spam about mortgage refinancing? Mm-hmm. And it went through my mind, unbidden, maybe it's a secret message. And I thought, ah, oh, my plot that I've been waiting for 50 years.
So you had been thinking about...
Oh, always.
Always.
It had always been percolating. It's so silly to say, but I just never had a good enough idea.
Okay.
I've thought about it many times.
So at that point then, so you've got your idea, it's been percolating, you've got your plot in mind. What I'm most fascinated by here is, how did you set out deciding what the rules were for the world that you're writing about, and how that relates to the world that you live in? I mean, you're writing about, it's in Boston, so you're dealing with landmarks, but do you talk about, you know, specific restaurants you like, or do you give them false names? You're dealing with certainly public figures at some point. You yourself are a public figure. Do you have a list of rules, like these are the things we can identify, these we can't, these are subjects I don't talk about, these are things I want to make sure I include?
What a fantastic question. And I handled that by crossing that bridge when I came to it, kind of thing. I mean, every one of those points that you bring up is something that I have thought about. In the smallest of senses, if something good happens at a place, I usually use the real name.
Mm-hmm.
If someone gets killed at the place, I generally make up where it is.
That's a fantastic rule.
Well, I think that kind of works. I try to keep geography correct,
okay,
so that if you're driving along the Massachusetts Turnpike and you get off at exit 17, that's Newton. You know, I try to make that be correct. But it is building a completely new fantasy reality. And in the world, in your personal fictional world, there are things that are correct and true for that world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I sort of had to learn to balance and juggle. I mean, I think I could, if you gave me prime time and said, I've made a change in one of the lines in your book, I could tell you what that was.
Yeah.
You learn to hold 90,000 words in your head, and who looks like what and who said what and how they sound and where they go and what the reality of your fiction is. And building that world was an incredible challenge.
It sounds like you're almost kind of hydroplaning a little bit over reality there. I mean, you're really close to it, but not quite in it.
You're making a new one. How often does that happen, that you're making a new reality? So you want people who open the book to open prime time and be in that world and feel comfortable and feel like things work and feel like the people are recognizable, just like your friends are. If your friends do something that's off or strange, you think, why would they do that? That doesn't seem right. And you need to have the characters in the book and their place in your new world fit and work.
Now, how does this play into your real world that you live in terms of when you're reporting on stories or talking with people you work with at the TV station? They're like, oh, is that going to be, you know, end up in the book? Or
it has changed my perspective. It has given me kind of a more humorous take on my work. I have spent so long as an admitted workaholic. I mean, all I thought about was work, absolutely married to my job for years. And I took it very, very seriously, and it's a very high stress, very high stakes thing. Now, sometimes when something happens, I think, oh, that'll be a wonderful scene, you know, and I look at it as like fodder, and I mm-hmm. love it, and I'm like, bring it on. You know, the weirder, the wackier, the better. Although I must say that things that happen in real life can be a lot stranger than things that can happen in books.
Well, it sounds like it's also brought some new excitement to your to the work you've been doing for quite a long time then.
Well, balancing my full-time job as a television mm-hmm. reporter and my full-time job as a mystery author mm-hmm. and my full-time job as a real person mm-hmm. has been quite a juggling act. You know, sleep was the first to go, I must say. And then cooking, you know, no more cooking. We eat, my husband and I eat a lot of pizza.
Well, and I have no doubt you're eating probably a lot of pizza right now, being on a book tour. You're actually in town right now for the Mystery Company bookstore with Jim Wang, who we have here in the studio as well. But you're also going to be back in town in just about a month or so for BoucherCon, the Mystery Writers Conference. And Jim, I wanted to have you talk just a bit about BoucherCon, because you know, anyone who's been listening to Art of the Matter knows that I'm just thrilled about the idea of the world's largest conference for mystery writers and fans is coming to Indianapolis in the middle of October.
We are thrilled to be able to bring it to Indiana. I think it's going to be a marvelous opportunity for our community to talk with, to meet, to get to know a lot of really wonderful writers.
The conference itself is, it's not limited to people who are mystery writers, so anyone can still register.
Oh, absolutely. Registration is wide open, and it is not primarily intended for writers. Mm-hmm. This is a conference for readers, for fans of the genre. I mean, many writers are, of course, fans of the genre, but we're getting together here in order to celebrate our common love for mysteries.
Give me just a little sample of some of the things that people are going to be able to experience. Of course, there's a lot of opportunities to meet your favorite authors and get books signed and things like that, but it goes well beyond that.
Right. You know, there are a lot of panel discussions organized around various aspects of the mystery. So we have a couple of discussions about historical mysteries, about the interaction between reality and fiction in a historical setting. We have sessions about the craft of writing, how one keeps a series going over a long term. There are sessions for folks who are interested in writing. So if you want to learn about how one takes those first steps into the business, we have sessions about that. We also have a lot of sessions that celebrate kind of the history and heritage of the genre. A group of writers will be talking about Edgar Allan Poe and his influence on their work and on the mystery genre. Raymond Benson, who worked on some of the 007 novels, is going to come and talk about the history of 007, the James Bond books. So it's a very wide range of programs.
And of course, one thing we were talking about earlier, one of the things that I'm most excited about is a big fan of Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe character. There's actually a dinner that is in celebration of the Nero Wolfe character that's based on the dinner that was prepared in the novel Too Many Cooks. And what a great opportunity that's going to be. There's a group of fans of Nero Wolfe's books called the Wolf Pack.
That's right. And they are helping us put together recreating this meal. You know, if you've read any of the Nero Wolfe books, you know that Nero Wolfe eats very well, and we thought it would be fun to try to do that ourselves.
Mm-hmm. At least just once.
Just once. It will be a once.
If you eat it every day, you end up being a sixth of a ton.
Well, that's right.
Most of the events that take place that are part of BoucherCon, you do need to register for.
Absolutely.
But there is one thing that's very exciting that we can give sort of a teaser about that is going to be open for everyone. That's going to be the announcement of the next book for One Book, One City.
That's right. That announcement will take place during BoucherCon. We'll be doing a reception at the New Central Library on Friday, which is the 16th of October, and the reception will be at 5:30 to 7 o'clock. We'll be celebrating Indiana's literary heritage with a group of Indiana mystery writers, and Mayor Ballard will be on hand to make the announcement about the One City, One Book title.
And we do know it's going to be a mystery. It's not just a mystery what the title is. We know that it is going to be a mystery.
Oh, absolutely.
That'll be very good. And there's one thing that, of course, Jim, we need to address quickly, and that is, where does the name BoucherCon come from? Because I know I get asked that all the time when I talk about it.
That's right. This conference is named in honor of Anthony Boucher, who was a mystery writer, reviewer. Most people know him as the Sunday New York Times book reviewer mm-hmm. who covered mysteries. He had, Marilyn Stasio has that job right now. Anthony Boucher had it for many years from the 1950s into the early 70s.
BoucherCon is the most amazing. I fumble discussing it because to walk down the hall and see you know, Laura Lippman and Harlan Coben and Sue Grafton
and Michael Connelly this year.
Michael Connelly and all these people, Nancy Martin. Everyone is very accessible. Everyone talks. Everyone has a this common love of mysteries. We've all read the same books. We all care about the same things. And there's such a spirit of camaraderie and such a spirit of fun and such a spirit of sharing. It is it's an absolutely amazing experience. So, of course, I wouldn't miss it. No one in the mystery world would consider missing it. Everyone will be there.
Well, and we're very lucky to have Jim Wang here in the Mystery Company Bookstore to help bring it here this year.
The Mystery Company is amazing. It is a treasure. And everyone who loves mysteries or thinks they might should make the trip to Carmel. I mean, Jim knows everything about mysteries. His staff knows everything about mysteries. They know the ones you want, and they know the ones that you don't even know you want. I mean, you've been there a million times.
Absolutely.
Travis DiNicola with mystery author Hank Philippi Ryan and Jim Wang, owner of the Mystery Company Bookstore. Hank's books Primetime, FaceTime, and the newly published Airtime are all available at the Mystery Company Bookstore in Carmel, just off the Monon Trail. For more information about her books, visit HankPhilippiRyan.com, Hank Philippi Ryan, Philippi with two L's and two P's, HankPhilippiRyan.com. BaoshiCon, the World Mystery Convention, takes place October 15th through the 18th in downtown Indianapolis, and you can still register at BaoshiCon2009.com, BaoshiCon2009.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Al Studios at alstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. It's our 10th anniversary show.
Well, that's right.
Woo-hoo.
Woo. And we'll have a special conversation to celebrate that 10th anniversary. Plus, I'll find out more about the new Indiana Authors Award the library's giving out.
I'll catch up with Encore Vocal Arts and find out what they're doing with Colt Porter.
Oh, that sounds good. And I'll chat with curator Chris West about his new gallery. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? Please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.